all of us. Everyone at the State's Academic Medical Center. All working together to deliver complete care now and for generations to come. All over the state, including hospital and clinic locations from the Delta to the Gulf Coast. All for one reason. You, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. All for your health.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
Our goal at Everyday Tech is to keep your technology not only working, but working for you. I'm the host, Abram Nanny, and you can join me and my friends Wednesday mornings at 10 on MPB Think Radio, or search Everyday Tech on your favorite podcasting app, or download the MPB Public Media app.
This is Southern Remedy Kids and Teens on MPB Think Radio. I'm Dr. Morgan McLeod, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Internal Medicine at UMMC. Today we are going to be talking about asthma. Asthma is a very common condition that we see in our kids. It does sometimes carry into adulthood, and we have adults that are diagnosed with asthma as they get older too. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about what happens with asthma and why some people are affected worse than others. And how we treat it. And if you have any questions or comments, I would love to hear from you. So send us an email to kids@mpbonline.org. We have been having lots of asthma flare-ups here lately with the allergies coming around. And we've still had a lot of people getting colds and upper respiratory infections lately. Usually it's kind of starting to slow down this time of year as March, you know, we're in April. I was going to say, as March is getting over and moving into April, but we're still having a pretty good bit of upper respiratory infections out there. And so with that, we hear a lot of wheezing. And so today I kind of wanted to differentiate like what wheezing is and what is truly asthma and what do we do to treat asthma? And maybe what are some of the things that you can think about if you've noticed some changes in your kids or grandkids with regards to wheezing. So essentially what causes wheezing is, you know, we're having trouble getting air out of the lungs. And so you have some inflammation and maybe some bronchospasm of those airways as they're trying to get the air out of the lungs. Now we have some things like our little babies that were born premature are going to be more prone to wheezing, especially when they get a little cold grow up. And that doesn't always mean they're going to have asthma. A lot of times we label that as reactive airway disease. And so that just means that these little ones, when they get colds, their airways are very sensitive and just a little hyperreactive. And so they'll wheeze a little bit with a cold. But it doesn't necessarily mean asthma. We also see wheezing sometimes with RSV. So everybody's probably heard the term RSV, and I know we've done some shows on RSV because everybody has questions about it. But RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, is a pretty common virus to cause a cold just in adults and even younger kids. But our babies are the ones who tend to get more affected by it, because what RSV does is it makes you have a lot of secretions, a lot of nasty kind of buildup in those airways. Well, little babies can't cough and move all that around like we can. And so therefore it gets built up. And then instead of like necessarily their airways spasming and being extra reactive and wheezing that way, they wheeze because they have a bunch of that mucousy nasty stuff built up in their airways that they can't really clear. And so they'll wheeze that way too. So you've got reactive airway disease. You may have like infections like RSV, or the term that we use is bronchiolitis, that can cause some wheezing, but you don't necessarily have true asthma. Other things that may make you wheeze is, I guess, a really bad case of bronchitis. Some people, you know, you may notice that if you get like a really bad case of an upper respiratory infection and then it just kind of settles in your chest and you just can't clear it and you're coughing all the time and you may hear a little wheezy here and there. It's kind of the same process like I was talking about with the RSV. Everything just gets a little swollen and inflamed and you've got some mucus and secretions in there. And so it just makes the airways a little more reactive. Another reason you can wheeze is COPD. Thankfully, we don't see that in our kids usually. There is, I guess, a condition that you could get it in, but typically COPD is a disease that as you get older, so probably not until like late 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s that you're going to see problems with COPD. Most patients with COPD have smoked, but not always. Like I said, there is a genetic condition that can do it. But majority of people with COPD that wheeze are going to have been smokers. Here lately, I have been seeing, and I actually talked to a friend of mine that's an adult pulmonologist about it. I've seen several patients lately having kind of an overlap of COPD and asthma. So we're going to get into this a little bit about how we can do some tests to test the lung function. And so we can look at those tests, and they all look a little differently based off of what disease process you have going on in your lungs. And so I have seen a fair amount of it within the past, like, year or two of patients that I've ended up having to send to the pulmonologist because they just have pretty bad airways. Like, it looks like their history sounds like COPD, but when I do their tests, it actually looks like they have a little touch of asthma, too. And so I've seen that, and she told me that they have seen a fair amount of that, too. So it's interesting because we typically think of asthma as more of a kid's disease, but we do see it in adults, and it can overlap with other conditions like COPD. So just a little interesting fact. So that's kind of the overview of wheezing. So there's I wanted to kind of introduce it that way because not everything that wheezes is asthma. I think a lot of people, you know, just assume that if we tell you that you're wheezing, that you're concerned that you have asthma. And while that may be the case, there is a good chance that just because you wheeze, and especially if you only wheeze once or twice, that you probably don't have asthma. And so that's good news because that means you probably don't have to be on an inhaler for a while. It may be that you just have like some reactive airways and you just need an inhaler every now and then, you know, if you have like a really bad cold or something like that. So what is asthma? Let's start with that now that we've kind of introduced that there are different reasons to wheeze other than just asthma. So essentially asthma is a chronic disease, so that means it stays there, in your lungs. So it's always there. So that's another thing to think about is asthma is not it's not going to come and go like this reactive airway that I talked about that you're only going to have problems when you get sick. Asthma is always there. The airway, so in your lungs, the big airways become narrow. Their linings, their bronchial linings are swollen. They're irritated. They're inflamed. And so it's always like that. Now, you may not always have a problem, but it's always like that. And then it flares up with different things. So it can flare up with allergies. It can flare up with a cold. It can flare up if you are, you know, next to somebody who's smoking a cigarette, whatever it may be. It's very, your airways are just so sensitive and they're already irritated and inflamed that it doesn't take much to get you wheezing and to get them angry. So that's one thing I wanted to kind of make sure people knew too, when it's different than just the reactive, like I said, airways, bronchitis kind of pictures, because you're always inflamed with asthma. And that's why it's so important, and it's hard for people to understand that, because sometimes they feel good, but we know that their lungs are sick. And so you have to take your, you know, inhaler and your medicines every day. It's kind of like high blood pressure. You don't really always know you have high blood pressure. You know, if it gets really high, you may get a headache. But you don't, you kind of forget you have it. It's the same thing with asthma. Your lungs are always irritated. It's always there. You just may not remember that you have it because you're actually feeling pretty good. But yeah, so asthma means that the airways are always inflamed, always irritated, but they're easily to get sick and to spasm down. Asthma is, like I said, mostly a condition of childhood. I saw a statistic that said up to 15% of kids in grade school have asthma. So, I mean, that's a pretty good bit of people that have had asthma or been diagnosed with asthma. We know when we break down asthma, a lot of it is allergy related. For most people with asthma, there is an allergic component to it. So if you have like a runny nose and really bad seasonal allergies, or maybe you had eczema as a baby, which is also an allergic kind of process, we know that you're probably more prone to get asthma. So if you wheezed a few times, we're going to be a little more proactive about, you know, diagnosing you with asthma as opposed to somebody who's never had allergy problems or eczema or any problems like that. So We know that there is probably an allergic component to it. Genetics probably play a role as well, because majority of the time, if you have had, you have somebody else in the family with asthma. Not always, but a lot of the times we see that. So there probably is some kind of genetic component to it as well. We also know that little babies who are exposed to secondhand smoke, cigarettes in particular, have a higher chance of developing asthma as well. So just kind of a little background about who we see asthma in. And this is not always the case, but majority of the time, there's going to be either a family history, an allergic component, or some kind of secondhand smoke exposure when we're diagnosing it with our children. All right, so we've kind of given a quick background on asthma and wheezing, and now I want to talk about a little more details about asthma. How do we diagnose it? How do we treat it? And then I found a cool little sheet about facts and fables about asthma, and so I wanted to address some of those too, because it may be some questions that you have. This is Southern Remedy Kids and Teens on MPB Think Radio. We are talking this morning about asthma, but we are here to answer any questions that you may have. Send us an email to kids@mpbonline.org. So before the break, we talked about just kind of a quick little background of asthma and that there are other things that make you wheeze and not all that wheezes is asthma. We talked about that asthma tends to run in families, so it's very common to see more than one person in the family with asthma. Asthma tends to run in people who have allergies and eczema, so a lot of people have that allergic component when it comes to their asthma. And then we also talked about how exposure to tobacco when you're younger can also increase your risk for asthma. So secondhand smoke exposure to our little babies can increase their risk for asthma too. So I mentioned how asthma is a chronic disease, that the airways are always inflamed, they're always irritated, and that is what leads to the wheezing. So that means they're easily angered because they're just irritated and inflamed in there. So any kind of little thing can set it off and to make it to where they spasm down, and that's when you get the wheezing with asthma. So how do we diagnose asthma? Because that a lot of people have those questions when they come in to clinic and they say, you know, their kid has gone to the ER or they've had to go to the urgent care multiple times for wheezing and get some breathing treatments. And then they're like, well, when can we be diagnosed with asthma or do we have asthma? How do you diagnose it? So it's pretty hard to diagnose. I mean, I wouldn't say hard, but it's not as easy to diagnose when they're younger. And the reason being because the best way to diagnose asthma is through breathing test. So you may have heard the term pulmonary function test. And so pulmonary function tests measure the lung capacity. And so what we do, if you've ever had one before, they make you take a big breath in, they make you take a big breath out, and then they tell you to blow all the way out. And then just when you think you're done, they say, blow some more. And I know most people tell you they feel like they're going to pass out when they're doing those tests because you just have to keep blowing really hard. So the asthma is a is what we call an obstructive disease, an obstructive lung disease. So it you have trouble getting the air out. And that's why it's so important for you to take that big breath in and then blow out. And then they tell you to blow again. And then a lot of times, too, with the pulmonary test, what we'll do is we'll give you an inhaler and say, do two puffs of this inhaler, give you a few minutes, and then we test you again to see how you responded. Because if you have that reactive airways and asthma like we were talking about, you will have a better test after doing the inhaler. So all that being said is, if you have a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old at home, you know how well they listen and how well they follow directions. They also probably are not the most coordinated when it comes to blowing things. You know, like my little girl loves to say, like whenever anybody has a birthday, like the grandparents or the cousins, she loves to sit in their lap and blow the candles out. But not much is happening when she blows the candles out. So that being said, it's really hard to do those kind of tests in our young kids. So we really just have to kind of diagnose it clinically. So that means based off of the history, if we feel strongly enough, based off the history and the family history, we may could diagnose you with asthma in those younger years. All right, we've got a caller on the line, so let's go to Clyde. Good morning, Clyde. What's going on?
Yes, thanks for talking about Kyle.
Yeah, what's going on?
This is a question. If you have external hemorrhoids, you can visually see it in a mirror. What's the prognosis when you have them? Do you get up in your 80s or 90s if you never get nothing done about it?
There's not much to worry about for the most part. If they're bothering you, then, you know, because sometimes those hemorrhoids can be painful. The other thing is sometimes they can be what we call thrombosed, where those vessels and those veins get really angry and irritated in there, and then those become really swollen, and it's really painful. But for the most part, most people, you know, and the hemorrhoids bleed too, but for the most part, people don't bleed enough with their hemorrhoids that it actually causes a problem. You may see a little blood like when you wipe, but for majority of patients, it's not going to make you bleed too much where you're going to become significantly anemic. Now, it does happen, and I've had several patients that we do have to send to GI and have a procedure done to get them banded so that they won't bleed anymore. But for most people, it doesn't cause much of a problem. What we tell you to do is just to make sure you keep your stools really soft. Miralax is kind of my go-to for that, or you can just take any stool softener, really. But the key is to take... you don't want to strain because that's what makes the hemorrhoids worse. So if you have really soft stools and you're going regularly, then you don't strain and you don't put a lot of pressure on those hemorrhoids, and really you usually don't have much of a problem. The problem becomes if they bleed a lot or if they're really painful. Otherwise, there's not much to do about it besides keeping your stool soft.
So what you're saying is, you can go your whole life and never even do nothing about it.
Yeah, you can. Most people, I mean, I would say, especially women, after having babies, it's pretty common for women to have them. But anybody that suffers from chronic constipation, which there's a lot of people out there that do, so there's a lot of people out there that have hemorrhoids and never really have much of a problem. Now, I would tell you to make sure that you get it examined by, you know, your doctor and make sure that they agree that it's hemorrhoids. You know, and as long as they agree that it's hemorrhoids, yeah, if it's not bothering you or if it's not bleeding bad, there's nothing really to do.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate the info.
Yeah, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Yeah, hemorrhoids are one of those frustrating things because they can be really painful. And there's not anything great to do about them. Cutting them out is very painful from what I hear. Never had it done to me, but patients say it is a really tough recovery. So we try not to do that if we don't have to, just because of the recovery process of it. Okay, so we talked about the pulmonary function test, and that's truly how we diagnose it. We also look at the severity of your symptoms. So some people may just get a cold and wheeze when they get a cold. Some people may wheeze all the time. It doesn't take much to set them off. Just walking outside it could be the cold, dry air that flares it up, or it could be the pollen in the air that flares it up. For some people, the heat flares it up. You know, it can happen for numerous different reasons why it gets bad. For some people, they don't really wheeze. They just cough all the time. And we do have that a lot. And that's one of the symptoms that we look at for asthma when we're looking at the severity of it, is one of the questions we always ask is, do you cough at night? Do you wake up coughing at night? Because that's a big symptom of asthma too. So you may never have truly wheezing. You may just be one of those ones that coughs, or you may be one of those ones that wheezes when you exercise. And that's one of the points I wanted to make sure we talked about too, is exercise induced asthma, because that's another pretty common one that we see in kids that can be fairly mild. So again, we look at the severity. We look at how often are you wheezing. Are you wheezing every day? Are you having to use the medicine to help the wheezing? Are you coughing every night? And then based off of that, between your pulmonary function test and looking at the actual function of your lungs and how severe it is there, and we look at your symptoms that you're having, and based off of that, we make a decision of how we should treat you for asthma. And so we'll talk a little bit about that and what what we use to treat for asthma. So how do we treat asthma? You've probably heard of the breathing treatments that we do for asthma. And there's different way to give breathing treatments. So there's the nebulizer machine, which I'm sure people have seen before. And it's that little machine that has like the compressor hooked up to it. And then you have the mask that you put on the kid. And you what you end up doing is you pour the liquid into the compressor. And then that helps change it into a mist that is inhaled into the lungs. There's also like an actual inhaler, or what we call a metered dose inhaler, and that contains the medicine too. And so what you do for that is you put it directly to your mouth. It's a little different because it's not a mask. You put it in your mouth, and you have to push down on the medicine and take a big breath in and hold it for a few seconds and then do it again. We like to do two puffs for pretty much every medicine. Now, it's a little more intricate when it comes to the directions on how to do it. And so, again, this is another thing that our little young kids probably aren't going to be able to do. I would have to ask an asthma doctor, a pulmonologist for sure, but I would say probably not until you're at least 5 or 6 years old do you really truly get how to use the meter dose inhaler. I don't know, maybe you could have some smart four-year-olds out there, but most kids, it's going to be probably 5 or 6 before they can truly figure out how to do the inhaler. So the nebulizer, if you've ever used a nebulizer before, you know you have to sit there for a little bit. It's not like one of those things that you can just like sit there and within, you know, 20 seconds it's done. They got to sit there for about 4 to 5 minutes usually to complete the full treatment. And trying to get a toddler to sit down for 4 to 5 minutes can be really frustrating. And then especially if they are like wheezing and you're starting to worry about them, their symptoms are getting worse, you want something done a lot quicker. So they do make this thing called a spacer that you can put onto an inhaler. And so what you can do is it essentially has a mask to it, and then it's got a long tube that you connect to the inhaler, to the end of the inhaler. And so the thought process is it's got like a little valve on it. So when you push the inhaler down to let the medicine goes through the tube and into the mouth, but it's got that valve that prevents it from going back up. So it all goes into your kid's lungs. So it's essentially like doing a quick nebulizer treatment, but you're getting a lot higher dose right there at one time. And then you do your two puffs and then you're done. So it saves a lot of time. For some reason, people really love a nebulizer and they feel like it works better. But the studies have shown that there's really not any difference between a nebulizer and proper technique of an inhaler. When it comes time to delivering the medicine. And then if you have a young kid and you want to use the inhaler, but you know they can't do it yet, ask the doctor for that spacer. Pharmacies have them. Majority of pharmacies have the spacers available. So you can put that spacer onto the inhaler, and then you don't have to sit and do the long nebulizer treatment. And so it just makes things a lot easier. But yeah, so the nebulizer and the inhalers are the biggest ways that we give the medicines that help treat asthma. The biggest one is albuterol. Probably people out here have all heard the term albuterol because it is such a super common medicine. And you may have actually been given it. You know, we give albuterol to those people who have really bad bronchitis, like I was saying earlier, who don't truly have asthma, but they have such a bad infection that it's irritated their airways and made them wheeze with their bad bronchitis or you know, maybe they have that reactive airway disease that we talked about earlier, not a true asthma, but they do wheeze some here and there. So albuterol is a quick medicine, and so what it does is it helps kind of just calm the airways down. So, you know, I mentioned that those airways are spasming down because they're already inflamed and irritated, and then that irritant gets in there and it just makes them spasm down. And so the albuterol, what it does is it goes and it relaxes those airways, and so it helps open them up, relax them, and let that air get out so it's not so tight in there and that the air starts flowing back and forth. That's going to be our mainstay treatment for asthma is the albuterol. Even if you just have mild asthma or exercise asthma, you know, albuterol is our number one treatment for it. Now, if it is more severe asthma and you're having more symptoms, then we're going to have to put you on a medicine that you use every day. So we will get into what medicines we use, and then I want to talk about what flares up asthma and some of those myths that we hear about asthma and answer some questions. This is Southern Remedy Kids and Teens on MPB Think Radio. We are talking today about asthma. And I'm here to answer any questions that you may have. It doesn't always have to be about asthma. You can ask us anything. You can always send us an email to kids@mpbonline.org. And we did have a caller call in and ask about a book, and it was the Lost Book of Herbal Remedies. To be honest, I'm not 100% familiar with it, but it seems like it just has a, you know, covers different natural remedies, and it has pictures of the different plants and things like that, where to find them and what they're used for. My thoughts on herbal remedies is I'm not opposed to it. You know, we've had a show dedicated to this not too many months ago, just like a month or two ago. Had a friend come on who was really into herbals and natural remedies, I guess like a little more Eastern medicine type things. And I'm not opposed to it. If you feel like it can be helpful, why not try it? If it's natural, I'm fine with it. My biggest concern is sometimes if you are on other medicines, you just have to be careful, because some of these medicines can interfere with the metabolism of your actual prescription medications. And so, like, if you have a history of heart failure per se, you know, some of these medications that we put you on for heart failure, you got to be careful with some of this natural stuff that you take, because it can maybe interfere with the metabolism of your prescription medicines, whether that be it makes them less effective, or maybe it actually, you know, increases the availability of it, and so you may get like toxicity from these medicines. So you just have to be careful when it comes to that. But I mean, if it is something natural that you have found and it is helpful, I mean, I'm all for it. Go for it.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm going to be your cynical devil's advocate friend.
Okay.
How much of alternative medicine, herbal medications, how much of that is just, or is there any one specific thing as a doctor that you would say, do not try that, that's just a rumor? Is there anything you would warn people against trying when it comes to that realm?
There's probably lots out there. I'll go the opposite and tell you some of the ones that have been found to be helpful.
All right.
How about that?
Since I was the grumpy, cynical one, I'll let you be the happy one. Okay.
I'll tell you the ones that have been proven to be helpful. Turmeric can be really helpful for anti-inflammatory stuff. A lot of people love turmeric. And it has been shown to be pretty helpful for anti-inflammatory properties. A lot of people with arthritis use it. People with cardiovascular disease use it. And so it's turmeric is pretty helpful and it's safe. So that's one that I would say I would use. Garlic has also actually been helpful. It can help some with the cholesterol and it's pretty good. Red yeast rice is another one that's actually has some proven benefits as well. Fish oil is good too for cholesterol, particularly triglycerides. You got to take a pretty good bit of it, but fish oil has been proven to be helpful. Saw palmetto is one that we use for prostate issues. So for men who have prostate issues, it truly can help with those symptoms of the prostate. Black cohosh is one that we recommend for women who have hot flashes and menopausal symptoms. So people who don't need to get on hormones, so maybe like you've had breast cancer or some kind of gynecological cancer that you don't want to get on hormones for, black cohosh can actually be helpful. So all of those are proven to be helpful. I'm trying to think if there's any other big ones off the top of my head that we say. I'm sure there's more. But those are just the big ones I think of. Cinnamon. Cinnamon is one that actually is really helpful, too. Cinnamon has a lot of good benefits.
Does it still have those benefits when it's mixed with sugar on top of a piece of bread?
Yeah, on
a
cinnamon roll. Probably not as good.
Darn.
cinnamon is another one that is pretty good, too. So, yes, I mean, I'm all for it if you think it's going to be helpful. You know, it's just some of these ones you got to be careful with about if they're going to interfere with the cytochrome processes and things like that of the way the medicines are broken down. Like St. John's Wort and Ginkgo Biloba, there's another big one. But those in particular are for sure going to interfere with the way some of those medicines are broken down. So you do have to be careful.
I had some girlfriends in college that were all about like primrose oil.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that one?
Yeah, I have heard of that one. I don't know much about that one, to be honest.
I think they just took it because it had a pretty name.
Yeah.
I'm too dumb to know what the big deal was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, if you, like, look up medicines, there's so many different things that it could potentially help. And does it truly help? Eh. My thing is, if it's not going to hurt you and you feel like it does help you, why not? It's fine to try it. But those ones that I mentioned off the top of my head are just the big ones that I think of that I know have proven benefits. So, okay, so back to asthma. So I mentioned earlier that albuterol is the medicine that we use as needed, and it quickly just relieves and calms down those airways, and it kind of opens them up so that you don't get so they're not spasming down. So what do we do if you have really bad asthma and you're having to use that albuterol a lot? That's when we worry. And we're like, oh, we got to do something about that. Steroids are going to be the main treatment for that. And now, not like steroids that you take by mouth. These are steroids that are inhaled through the inhaler or through that nebulizer that we mentioned earlier. And this is a thing that you have to do every day. So what the steroids are doing is they're decreasing that inflammation that's in your airways, that's really got your airways irritated, so that hopefully the next time you're exposed to something, it's not going to make them go so crazy and spasm down. So you do the steroids every day. Now, people freak out when we say it is a steroid, and rightfully so. Steroids have a bad reputation. However, it is not, there's very minimal systemic absorption. So that means that there is not a lot of the steroids that are going into your body and your blood system. It's more directly into your lungs and into your airways. So the absorption on that is pretty small. So the effects of steroids is like not going to give you diabetes. It's not going to increase your appetite. It's not going to make you crazy. Any of the side effects that we think about with steroids. Another one that a lot of people worry about when we start kids on steroids in particular is their height, because we know that long-term steroids can affect kids' height too, and bone strength and things like that. And it is like very minimal. I think the studies show it's like 0.5 centimeters, which is not even half an inch if you stay on the steroids. So very minimal effect. So it's pretty safe, even though I know it sounds scary to tell you to do a steroid every day. Again, the systemic absorption of it is pretty minimal, and it mostly works just directly on the lungs. So just to kind of relieve some of those fears about it, if you have been told you need to be on one of those steroid inhalers. All right, we have another caller, so we will go to Richard. Good morning, Richard. What's going on?
Good morning. I was just diagnosed with, I believe the pronunciation is, eosinophilic asthma,
mm-hmm.
and I also have GERD, I guess a weakening of the esophageal sphincter. Tons of allergies, and I struggle to find a discipline that addresses the intersection of the two.
Yeah, so the eosinophilic asthma is one, I would say, have you seen an allergist for it?
Pulmonologist.
Yeah, you may want to consider an allergist because we had talked a lot, asthma can have an allergic component to it, and eosinophils are one of those one of those white blood cells that we think of for allergic type responses. And so the pulmonologist is a great place to start, but you may want to consider seeing an allergist too, because they may can combine some of their processes and treatments. There's one in particular I know of out in town in Jackson that she is dual trained in pulmonary and allergy. So you may want to try to find somebody like that who has a little bit of background in both. But I would suggest reaching out to an allergist.
Okay, and I am under the care of one, taking allergy shots now for a year.
Oh, good, yeah.
Probably. And they did a new panel and uncovered some other things.
Okay, yeah. And now there's a lot more targeted therapies for asthma now in particular, which is nice. Not just doing the steroids and things like that. There's lots of things that we can, if we know you have eosinophilic asthma or certain other types of asthma, we can target it a little bit better. So they may be able to do some of that treatment for you. One other thing I would say just while I have you on the phone is if your reflux is not very well controlled, you probably want to consider seeing a GI doctor and getting scoped, because if you have eosinophilic asthma, you can also get eosinophilic esophagitis, where you have a high presence of those eosinophils in your esophageal lining too, and the only way to diagnose that is to go in there and actually take biopsies of it.
Right, and I've done all that. I'm just not very disciplined when it comes to saying no to burritos and pizza.
Yeah, well, I feel you on that one. It's okay. I get it. Okay. I get it. Well, I just wanted to make sure you had been tested for that too. So, but yeah, I would try to see if talking between your allergist and your pulmonologist, there may be somebody that is dual certified that you could reach out to.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Good luck. Thanks for your call. This is Southern Remedy Kids and Teens on MPB Think Radio. We have been talking about asthma, but we're here to answer any questions that you may have. If you don't want to be on air, you're a little too shy, you can always give us an email, too. Lacey said she is checking our email, and she will make sure we get back to you. So give us an email at kids@mpbonline.org. All right. Well, we have another caller on the line. We've got Kat. Hey, good morning, Kat. What's going on?
Good morning. I have a quick question, or it may be quick, in regards to my two-year-old. He recently was diagnosed with allergies to wheat, soybean, eggs, milk, and peanuts, which is just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't have asthma yet, as you were saying, because he's too little to be diagnosed with it. And he also has eczema, too, so a whole host of things. Yesterday, I had to use the EpiPen on him because he was having trouble with breathing. And so I guess my question is just how do I navigate finding diets that are appropriate for him besides just, like, meat and vegetables? Because that's what my husband and I have, like, come down to. It's just we'll give him rice, oatmeal, meat and vegetables. So we're just looking for wisdom on how to navigate diets and just interactions in society, you know, and how to kind of keep them safe.
Yeah, so that's so tough. I'm so sorry y'all are having to deal with that. One thing I would say is to see if your pediatrician or your allergist can set you up with a nutritionist. Nutritionists mm-hmm. are not readily available, but y'all are in Mobile, so I'm sure South Alabama, probably the pediatrics department there, has some access to nutritionists. So one, I would reach out through them and see if you can find a nutritionist somewhere. A lot of our specialties have nutritionists, and so me as a primary pediatrician, I don't have access to one, unfortunately, but I oftentimes will reach out to some of those nutritionists in other specialties, and they'll be willing to help me out and see my patients, even if they're not truly going to see them for, you know, endocrine or GI, whatever it may be they're associated with. So first, I would try to reach out through them, because I would think you could probably have some resources through South Alabama. Second, you know, I would look into some social media support groups. You know, we've talked in here about how social media is not always the best thing, but in certain situations like this, these are really good. You can get on, like, Facebook groups and things like that that have other moms who have kids who have the same allergies, and I think you would be surprised at just how much information you can learn from them, especially moms who have older kids who have been through this, and they can tell you kind of how they've navigated it. I think that's a really good resource for you, because there's all kinds of groups out there, and you can ask questions and what have you found to be good snacks for your kids, what did you do about when your kids started kindergarten and, you know, they're having all these parties, and how do you keep them from being exposed. So I think those are two places I would start to get you some good resources for that, because I know it's really scary, and especially if you've had to use the EpiPen on them before. It sounds like the allergies are pretty severe. So I would definitely talk to them about that. And you know, a nutritionist, one, and two, see about if you could find a local support group that could help you with that.
Yes, ma'am. I'll definitely look into that. And I thank you. And I would like to add a point that he had the I guess, pre-asthma. I forgot the term that you used, the respiratory something.
Like the reactive airway?
Yes. There we go. So he already had that, and he had the eczema, which was fine. But it wasn't until the end of February, the beginning of March, after he had COVID, that the eczema just, it significantly worsened to the point where he would, like, scratch chunks of his skin, because, of course, he's a baby. He doesn't know how to scratch without, you know, tearing up his skin.
Mm-hmm.
And then the allergies and all this stuff just kind of came out of nowhere. So it's just like, you know, it's just really overwhelming, because he's been eating these things before, and now it's like cold turkey. So
yeah, I would definitely, I know that's so frustrating. You know, I would, a nutritionist is a great place to start, though, just because when you're having to eliminate so much from your diet, you also want to make sure that he's still getting all the nutritional components that he needs, too. So when you cut everything out, I'm sure there's going to be times where he may be lacking in certain, you know, vitamins and minerals. So you want to make sure, talking to the nutritionist, they can help you come up with a good plan.
Yes, ma'am. Well, you all have been awesome. Thank you for answering my question, and I hope y'all have a good day.
Yes, thank you so much for calling. We appreciate it. Good luck with everything. I know that's so frustrating. I talked to, you know, we've had Dr. Grogan on here before about allergies, and I've asked him to come back, and hopefully he'll be back in the next month or two to talk about food allergies, because it is such a common topic these days. We're seeing more and more food allergies, unfortunately. The good thing is that there's also coming out more and more therapies for food allergies. So like peanut allergies in particular, they have oral immunotherapy now. So when you hear people getting allergy shots, that we call that immunotherapy. So essentially what you're doing is you're slowly exposing people to that allergy so that over time their body becomes used to it, and so they're not as like overwhelmed by the allergy per se. And so that's the thought process behind it. And they've come up with a safe plan for that for peanuts now. So you can do that. You can actually get on oral immunotherapy and slowly work your way to where you can tolerate peanuts. Or, you know, maybe in your son's case, it sounds like his are pretty severe, so may not always tolerate it, but at least won't have as severe of a reaction. That's another thing. So it's a safety kind of thing. Because when they go to school, they could potentially be, exposed to it. So they're coming up with all kinds of new stuff.
We didn't know my sister had a cat allergic reaction until we had, like, four cats in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, do we take my sister get an allergy shot every few weeks, or do we get rid of our four family pets? So sister got allergy shots.
Allergy shots, yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, it happened.
And it helped. It really did help. And I think the shots plus growing up with cats her whole life, I think it just got better. But now that she's an adult, she doesn't live at the parents' house in Alabama. Whenever she comes back, the cats make her sneeze. So my addition to the allergy conversation.
Yeah. Well, we have a good family friend who is a vet and who is obsessed with cats and has multiple cats herself. And now she has a serious boyfriend, and he was allergic to cats. And so we've been like, what are you going to do? And I saw her not too long ago, and apparently he has started allergy shots for the cats.
I would have said, man, you're going to miss that boyfriend.
Yes, allergies can be so frustrating. So just real quick, we got like 1 minute left. So I just wanted to hit up about asthma. You know, one thing that people say is you grow out of asthma. And do you truly grow out of it? It's probably still there. There's always a chance that, that the symptoms could return. But for majority of people, as you get older, those wheezing symptoms tend to get better. So that is something to know. So it's not like truly growing out of it per se, because there's a chance that it could always come back. But a lot of people that have to be on inhalers every day when they're younger, by the time they're teenagers, 20s, 30s, 40s, that's kind of a distant memory at that point. So that is reassuring. The other thing I wanted to say is you can still play sports and have asthma. But I would recommend that you have a good asthma protocol to prevent you from having too bad of episodes when you play sports. Some people, all they have to do is take a couple of puffs of that albuterol inhaler before they do any kind of activity. But for some people, they actually need to be on those inhalers every day to prevent it. But you can still play sports and have asthma, as long as you've got a good plan in place with your doctor. So I just wanted to make sure we address those, because a lot of people have questions about that. Well, this has been a great show. Thank y'all, everybody, for your calls. This has been Southern Remedy Kids and Teens, a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting and Think Radio, and is funded in part by a grant from the University of Mississippi Medical Center and generous support from listeners like you. Lacey was our show engineer, and I'm not sure who our call screener was. I saw Liz running around, so maybe it was Liz.
It was Charles.
Oh, Charles. Sorry, Charles. Thanks, Charles. I'm Dr. Morgan McLeod. Join us next Thursday at 11 for Southern Remedy Kids and Teens, and stay tuned for NPR's Here and Now, coming up next on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.